All right. Good evening, everybody. Welcome. 5:30. I think it's fair to say good evening. So, welcome to our session about Swagger. My name is Max Knorr. I'm a senior program manager in the global ISV team at Microsoft. So, I guess you are aware ISV means independent software vendors, those companies that produce products instead of projects, and my team, myself especially, is working with five ISVs across two interesting areas that don't belong together, aviation and banking. So it's quite interesting. I have two product companies in aerospace and three in banking. But the topics are always the same, and a lot of the conversations go along contracts for web services, modern contracts for web services. And then we have to bring up that non-enterprise term here, Swagger. And obviously, everybody got attracted. I guess you guys are aware that the swag, I know that from conferences like that one, when you walk around downstairs and you ask, do you have some swag? Then you mean like a shirt or something. This is not swagger like that. So we don't have any swag here for you. Sorry, no shirts or anything. The only thing I can offer is some few drinks for the first 9 people or so. There's water, but that is it. But Swagger has a lot to offer, nevertheless, and we'll spend the next 45 minutes exploring Swagger in more detail. Swagger is a contract for REST, so we have to start with some REST basics. Before we do that, let me ask a few questions. So, who in the audience is developing software? That's like the boring one. Okay, cool, I'm in the right track, not the CTO track or anything. Who is developing software in .NET? Wow, majority of people are. Who is using something else than .NET? Some people are. You want to scream out something? Node, Java? You want to declare yourself Node? Node, cool. All right. What else? Who's building REST web services? Majorities. Who's already using Swagger? Wow, why are we here, guys? We'll see. You tell me afterwards whether you learned anything new, whether I did any mistakes, but it sounds a lot of people are familiar with Swagger. So I guess you're familiar with REST as well. Representational state transfer. Few people don't actually know what it means. You are aware that REST services are natively built on HTTP, so other than SOAP, they are aware of verbs, and we can utilize verbs to express things. If we want to create a new resource, then we call it via post or via put. If we want to delete it, very creative, we do a delete. There's more creative things like options and heads. Has anybody used options and head in a service that they built? Some of you have. All right. So that is REST. I guess you're also aware that URLs, first of all, not sure how it is here. I'm from Austria originally. I'm not a native English speaker. But my girlfriend said recently she had found a nice URL about a website. I'm like, what do you mean URL? So apparently, I don't know if URL is the right way to say it. I keep saying URL. But anyway, URL, URLs, whatever. They are a built-in piece of a unique core piece of REST. So if I want to address a certain car, I do that through the URL or URI, whatever. I say I want a car with a certain number plate. In this case, this is Wien, Vienna, capital of Austria, with a very unique number. I want to get the owner and especially the name property of the owner. Or I want to get another person with the ID 123. I want to get a pet with, that's my cat, Schnurli, and I want to get some info about the cat in JSON format. So hey, this is super stupid, right? I mean, this looks like a website. This is maybe not a JSON file on the disk, but it's just metadata packed up in URLs so that it looks nice for us. This is not really correlating to physical folders or files on the server. Moving on, you are aware that we can use other native stuff in REST web services. We can use content types to negotiate what should be sent forwards and backwards, MIME types like JSON, images, XML. And there's a variety here, and this will become the problem in a few slides. And then we can use HTTP status codes to actually tell things back. If the Schnurli cat here, the pet Schnurli, is not found, what should we return? 404. Ah, very simple, right? But when I'm not going to tell you which company it was, but even though it is so simple, one of my five partners, and when they watch the video, they can guess who it was. One of my five partners said, yeah, we return 200 and a JSON message. It says error message equals pet not found. Why would you do that, right? We have status codes in HTTP, so it's nice to use them. 404, 400, 20. If you search them on the internet, REST HTTP status codes, there's a ton of meanings. What could they mean for your scenarios, for your particular scenarios? Like field validation failed, right? This is not an easy one. Is that a 500? I don't know, right? And then, yeah, encryption, we don't have any sophisticated SOAP. Oh, I didn't ask the SOAP question, we'll go there. We don't have any sophisticated SOAP message level encryption. We just have TLS, HTTP transport level security. The SOAP question, who was building SOAP services previously? I see a lot of young people like my age in the audience. Oh, most of you have been building. Are you still building them? Yeah, so like in parallel. Okay. That will become interesting. So other than in SOAP, in REST services, the content is not standardized. And that is the biggest burden, right? It could be, or well, the biggest benefit maybe as well. It could be XML, JSON, CSV, images, HTML, text, you name it. There we go. Here's the problem. So that could be a car. I mean, the quotes are wrong as usual in PowerPoint. But that could be a car with a license plate being sent back if I request application/JSON. And we can skip that, but if you ever need a nice slide on JSON, come back. But I guess everybody knows JSON then. But I'm not sure about JSON schema. I only learned a while back that there is such a thing. Because in XML, we have XSD. In SOAP, we have WSDL even. But how about JSON? If you search on the internet, if you search XSD, JSON, there's all kind of ideas. But jsonschema.org is right now, I think, still in draft, is trying to find the standard approach. Let's zoom in slightly. So this is one single definition of a complex object. It's a recipient. Recipient is an object, and it has, in this case, two properties. We omitted some. And there is first name, and there is address. And then required is some other properties that are apparently omitted. So, but the thing is, with the properties, you can there's data types, and with the properties, you can either use simple properties, so first name is a string, or address actually references another type definition. So $ref says in this case address is defined somewhere else. This is the root of the document, definitions/address. That's like XPath almost, right? We're reinventing the things all over again. I was at university 10, 11, 12 years, well, must have been 12 years back, and my professor had said, I don't get SOAP. They are reinventing CORBA all over again. And this feels a lot similar, right? A lot of the concepts are familiar. If you are from the SOAP world, they are reinventing the wheel again. But there is some benefits, as we will see. So that could be a complex type definition. For instance, we can read it. WSDL is not that easy to read. I think that's the first benefit. Why do we need contracts at all? That's not just a legal question, but basically this nice living document could be a way to document your web services, right? If you have to, there's not a lot in here, basically, but everybody hates writing documentation. So I think one benefit of actually using a contract language is you can use it to generate documentation, or even better, be the documentation. So the contract is a WYSIWYG documentation, essentially, because it's the implementation as well, right? They can be used to auto-generate the code. We know that from WSDL days, from SOAP, WCF, whatever you want to call it. There is a way to generate a proxy or even a server. And that can be done here as well. You can generate code. The contract's always up to date, because if it's not in the contract, it's also not in the server, right? It can be used for validation. So if you want some layer 7 firewall somewhere that checks is the XML or JSON or whatever we're sending through, is that still valid? With Nginx or whatever reverse proxy you might have, then the schema can be used as well, the contract. And yeah, we did cover some of these contracts. And XSD or JSON schema, they are both for the internal payload, right? So the JSON that's being sent back and forth, or if it's XML, I can specify in REST services. But how about the methods? How about get, post, put? We didn't even mention Swagger yet. You did realize that, right? With that, let's go into a first quick demo, and you see the green Swagger logo coming up on the next slide. But before we go there, who is using contract first? Oh, there we go. Here's a new thing. So maybe you are, maybe you call it differently. This is a contract, a Swagger contract, or OpenAPI specification contract. And it's actually nicely written in YAML, yet another markup language. It's a very clever language that counts the number of tab keys, right? So here's like two tabs, here's one tab, and basically this is one object, and then this is a property. It's very simple. This is an array, things like that. So that makes it very easy to read it. And we see there is actually, speaking of reading, guys in the last row, can you still read /parcel? You can. Good. So there is /parcel as a path, as a URL. We're calling it with post. And then there's a description, and this is markdown. There's operation ID, parameters, responses, security. It's all well defined. A URL with a placeholder. It's everything in here. And now we have that, we can actually go and say, generate me a server out of that. And that is contract first. We're building the contract at first, in the first place. And only then we're generating the implementation for the contract, actually. And we have a broad choice of interesting frameworks in here. I haven't heard all of them, but we could say ASP.NET. And we have the same for clients. There's a C# or C# 2.0 client. And now it's actually building me, in this case, server stubs. It's building me server classes that I can use to build my web API, right? So here's, it's not cleanly built because it's only one single file, but we can group them up or split them up into multiple files if we wanted to. So we have a contract, a Swagger contract, and we can create client and server classes out of that contract and do other nasty things, as we will see. So with that, let me introduce to you Swagger. We saw it already. It has a nice green logo. It is on swagger.io. It is the WSDL of the REST world. So it allows us to do all these, the contract of the REST world. It allows us to do all these magic things that we mentioned and even more. Of course, as we've seen, it's not language specific. So it's not like .NET remoting that only works from C# to VB.NET, but it works across all the platforms, of course. Actually, they're renaming it as we speak to OpenAPI. That sounds even better than Swagger. OpenAPI is under Linux Foundation. It's a consortium of members. We as Microsoft are in here, but there's others in as well. And that is, in SOAP times, Oasis. You could say maybe OpenAPI is on the way to becoming the new Oasis of the REST world, the standard committee. Swagger is a sitemap. We've seen that. So we've seen it lists all the operations, it lists all the parameters, it lists the payload, the objects used, and it lists the status codes. Basically, it's a full description of REST services. There's two languages that Swagger speaks. And before we go there, Swagger also means the cool person, the person that prags off, right? That is very proud and bold. So that's, there was a slide, but I did cut it out. But if you look out Swagger on the internet, you'll see what we mean. It's a bold person that speaks highly of themselves. In this case, it speaks highly of your software, of your REST services. I think that's why they called it like that, but we don't know, to be honest. So Swagger speaks two languages. It can brag about your application in YAML or in JSON. And you are free to choose either format. Me personally, when it comes to writing it, YAML seems the easier choice because you don't have to do all these curly brackets. I have enough curly brackets in C# anyways, so why would I go JSON then? But either way, whatever works better for you is going to be fine. We did start the demo around contract first, but to go back and show you the editor one more time is actually quite cool. So there is a preview on the right, and that's the documentation that's going to be created automatically, Swagger UI. And as we type along, we see the documentation on the right changing. So it's actually very interactive. And as we add another option here, let's say we're adding the option of having an error code 404, description not found. Actually, the new error code immediately shows up here. If we take it away or if we change to a more meaningful message, it updates automatically over there. So that's editor, swagger.io, and there's other third-party tools as well, but it's actually quite convenient to write the contract in editor.swagger.io. It's free to use, it can export it, and this is my preferred way, or in Visual Studio Code, there's a quite similar experience of just writing the contract and having a live view on it as well. We did see the C# option, so we'll skip that. But the other interesting thing is, if we download, for instance, Node.js, there's only a few Node.js people, so that's going to be new for majority of people. If we say generate server Node.js, this is going to give us the whole YAML contract and code generated for Node.js. And Node.js is just this index JavaScript file. So we can say index.js, bring it up. Is listening on localhost 8080, and this is gonna look a lot similar once we have the right URL /docs. We'll get another graphical view on it, right? So we see again the same operations, And we can try calling one of these as well here. Let's zoom in slightly. So track a parcel with its ID. Tracking ID 123. We can say try out. It shows us this is how you would call it via curl. And by the way, curl exists now on Windows as well. So you can also run this on Windows. This is the URL we would call, and what we would get back is nothing except the response code 200 and these headers. So it's not very verbose in this case, but that's the implementation of the server. When I change the REST implementation, this will be updated as well. So this is a demo client that is actually just calling the stubs. And if I try it out with something else, then yeah, it updates and it's still 200. It's always gonna return 200. So that could be shipped already to customers as an interactive documentation. And then you see up here, this is actually the raw URL. So instead of, this is very meaningful. One is slash docs, and the other one is slash API docs. And API docs is the one that gives us the raw JSON in this case. So even though I imported the YAML, it's giving us back the JSON, and it, well, gives us the same schema again and again, the one that we just saw. All right, that's like the basics. Now, let's actually talk YAML. Let's go into some of the objects that Swagger has in its structure. There is an info section, which is generic metadata. There is all the operations and paths under a paths section. There is data types in JSON schema that are under definitions. On the various security definitions, so that's groups, you could say, groups of users, schemes of users. There is tags, random tags that you can apply. Produces, consumes is which MIME formats can be used in the service. So that could be application JSON, image slash JPEG. Responses, this is all the HTTP status codes, and parameters, this is a query string parameter or things like that, a body parameter. And this is a sample of info. Info section is quite stupid, we can skip that. This is a list of data types. Interesting to note is that the data types are quite limited in the sense of integer, and number is the only two number formats that do exist. So if you want to restrict further, then there is a second property, not just type, but format, and then you have to restrict it further. So there is a number float, number double, integer int 32. Feels a bit weird in the first place, but we're in JavaScript. Don't forget that, right? Or if you want to express a byte, then you're saying it's a string with a byte format. Base64, of course, right? Encoded. Or you can say there's a string with a date format. So a lot of the more restrictive types come through format. Keep that in mind. Then there's the definitions section. And definitions is what we've seen before. So this is the objects that we are sending back and forth in the JSON. And this is regular JSON schema. So we have properties with a type. We have these required fields in YAML notation. This is an array in YAML notation. This is always object or string, right? Or something else. But there's if it is a complex object, then this is always object. This is the required properties. So a more complex definition is here. We do have inheritance in. That's actually interesting, kind of inheritance. Remember, we're in JavaScript, so, we're saying, and this is really weird, we're saying this is all of two things. So it is A and B, right? And it is a reference to definitions person. We are under definitions recipient here. So somewhere we defined a person as well. And I want to make this recipient a combination of that person and additional properties. So this is not really inheritance. This is more extending an object of person with additional properties. And here you see the wonderful type number format float, right? And also the pattern, so we can have regular expressions in, we could say a postal code. This is Austria and Germany, for instance. It shall be a regular expression like that, for instance. So Swagger can even do a pseudo inheritance, although I did call it combination because inheritance is a bit too much. Then there's the paths section, and paths is really URLs and verbs. So in this case, slash parcel with a post with a get, or warehouse with a get. Now warehouse has a path parameter in. This is almost like in web API already, right? With the URL routes. So this is a placeholder that can then be used like this. For instance, you can say warehouse slash code get, and it has these parameters, only one in this case. Name is code. Code comes from up here. It is in the path, it is required, etc. And then we also see the response is 200404. So it's actually ridiculously simple once you know how it works. Besides having path, so of course there can be tracking ID, code, multiple up here, but you can also reference things in the body. Of course, body can only be in put and post, it cannot be in get. But like here, you can say a property reporting details is part of the body. It's also required, and it is another object that was defined somewhere else. And in this case, we operations. Well, that should be a small s. But in this case, there's like three parameters: two coming out of the path, one and two, and the third one out of the body. Security, this is evaluated by some of the Swagger frameworks, some maybe ignore it, but basically you can supply basic security, you can supply API key based security. If it is API key, then you can specify, is the key in the header, in the HTTP header, or is it in the query string? And then there's also OAuth security as well. And then you can apply these schemes and you can say there is either some global security that applies to all operations, or you can apply it on the semi, well, not global, but really on each operation. Post has admin security, get has OAuth security, for instance. So admin and OAuth security, that's the predefined names from last page. Now, this is the contract, and once we've written it, we can, for instance, use Swagger UI. We have seen Swagger UI. Swagger UI is auto-generated. If you are in .NET, then it's not called, well, it is called Swagger UI, but the package is called Swashbuckle. I'm sure you've used it. But if not, I'm going to write down the name. Swashbuckle. I don't know what that means in English language, to be honest. But that is the NuGet package that installs Swagger on top of Web API. Okay. And yeah, of course, the Swagger UI is not really generated up front. It's generated on the fly, so it's always up to date. We have seen Swagger UI. This is Swagger UI essentially, and it's always generated for you as part of Node or any other. with that, we're switching gears. I think you have a good picture now about the basics of Swagger. We could go on around the individual properties, but it's quite late, so I don't want to bore you with all the inheritance combinations. But let's go to some of the more fun things you can do on top of Swagger. First of all, is somebody using OData here in the audience? Some people are using OData. So if you are using OData, there is this, here it is, swashbuckle.odata module, which is an implementation to use OData for together with or on top of Swagger. So it adds these $filter, $expand, or whatever other properties you have in OData into Swagger automatically. Take a look at that package if you are using OData and you want to switch to Swagger. Next thing is validation in Swagger, or validation with Swagger. And that's actually nice. Let me show you a quick example in Node.js again. Let's open up, this is not the right file, let's open up this here. And we'll see there is Swagger validator here, app use middleware Swagger validator. Swagger validator, Swagger router, Swagger UI. Swagger UI we discussed. Swagger validator is actually validating the incoming requests and is checking whether the structure is right. So here it says there is a post method. It's called post parcel. And it submits a new parcel to the logistics service. And it shall be called like this. All right, let's do that. But I'm a bad typer. I think we have a typo in here. For some reason, I'm not writing tracking ID. Oh, and it should be, should be a string here maybe. But I'm typing tracking. And when I call this with a wrong schema, pressing try out here, it calls the server, and actually the server gives me back parameter new parcel failed schema validation. So it's realizing that even though I entered a correct string, the schema here is incorrect. This should be tracking ID. I can remove that, see how that is going. I'm passing in the wrong data type. Instead of a string, I'm passing in a number. Again, it tells me new parcel failed schema validation. I'm sure there's more details in here. What is wrong? And when I go in and now change that to a string finally, try it out. Okay, now I broke it. We have to. It's never a right schema.
That's your response, by the way.
Oh, thanks. See? He said that's your response. That is obvious, yeah. Kind of. Bless the validation. I cannot copy that. That's a bit weird. You sure? No, I'm clicking. Okay. First name. No, we're not gonna do this. Anyway, we'll leave it that when I hit try out, it still says the validation failed. Can I? I need a different browser. Good point. What empty? What do you mean? This one. Oh, there you go. Bless you. Yes. We have to do it one more time. Empty the text box and click it. That's super cool. I learned something here. Wow. Then it works and we get back the fake tracking ID here. So that is validation. It's validating the input life with the schema. The other thing that you can do is test generation. When we go out here and go into tests, there is a test generator package. I'm calling the Node.js code here. And all it does is it has this Swagger test templates, which is a NPM package, Node Package Manager package, and then it's calling test gen. And then it's basically writing the generated files to disk. And what that gives me is auto-generated tests for the different web service calls. For instance, this one here, this is now a JavaScript-based test. It's describing this call here. It's describing post. It has some definitions. Then it's actually calling the service. It's saying I'm expecting 200. So this is a kind of unit test-ish. It's not really a unit test. It's more an integration test, but it's a kind of unit test-ish way to write a test in this case through standard frameworks. And obviously, this cannot only be done in Node.js, but also in other languages if the generators do exist. So you can generate your tests through the Swagger. The next thing on top of Swagger that you can utilize is, and we're at a Microsoft conference, so Azure API management. There's other API gateways as well, but we have one in Azure, which is API management. So API management, a gateway in front of your Swagger service. So instead of calling the Swagger-based REST service directly, you're calling Azure API management. Why would you do that? API management takes away some burden from you, like it can do throttling, but it can do throttling based on certain API keys, for instance. So if you authenticate with API key A, it gives you a different throttling. There is three components. There is a gateway that does the throttling, whatever other policies. There is a publisher portal. This is where you publish the APIs through a Swagger contract, for instance. And then there is a developer portal that is like Swagger UI, but has more stuff in there, like more samples, for instance. Let's take a quick look at API management. It can be created, so we're in the API management portal here, and the whole portal account can be created through the Azure portal. Right now it's in the old Azure portal, manage.windowsazure.com. And basically, all starts with an API dashboard of all my APIs that I've got and what the usage is. I can import APIs here. So I can say I want to import my Swagger contract, for instance. Let's take that. I want to import in here. As you say, there's two formats available. WADL, which is like WSDL, but for REST services. But that's mostly in the Java world, and Swagger. I can add that to an existing API. I can override it. And then basically I get a new URL that is something azureapi.net. So I've added the parcel logistics service in here already. You see it's all these operations again. And now the interesting thing is I can define a product on top. So right now there's a product starter, and the API is part of my product starter. There is also a product unlimited, but the API right now is not in there. And then on top of these products, I can define policies. For instance, I can say the product starter on parcel logistics service is not specific. It's on all the APIs right now. There's a certain policy, and the policy is down here. So if you are a starter by API key, for instance, and you're calling the API, then, let's zoom in, you have a rate limit of 5 calls per 60 seconds, I guess. Or you have an overall quota or things like that. So you can add policies, and there's a whole load of policies. You can cache stuff on top. So there's an example where, for instance, they when you call the API, they first of all reach out to Google Maps or Bing Maps, and they get the GPS data. So they get the address for your GPS coordinates, and they all do that within these policies, because there can be some C# code in here as well. You can log your calls to Azure Event Hub. You can restrict calling it, you can rewrite it. So that's like Nginx plus plus plus, you could say, with a visual editor on top, and allows you to share your APIs as products. So if you have public APIs that you're selling, if you want to throttle, monitor, then API management is the right thing for you. Next interesting thing is Azure Logic Apps. Has somebody used Azure Logic Apps in the audience already? Okay. Has somebody used Windows Workflow Foundation? Here we go. A few. Have somebody used BizTalk? Okay. It's always the same people. So Azure Logic Apps is, or Microsoft Flow. Has somebody used If This Then That? Same people again. Azure Logic Apps and Microsoft Flow is an orchestration engine, a workflow engine. But it's not based on .NET, it's not based on C# or anything. The activities, the boxes, are REST services. So what both Logic Apps and Flow do is, they call one REST service, the blue one, then they call the green REST service, and then they call whatever, right? So the only difference is the same engine, more or less. The difference between Flow and Logic Apps is one is really for end users, and the other one is really for us as professional developers. So let's look into Logic Apps quickly. We have Outlook open. So I did create a new Logic App already, and we'll create another one in a moment. But it gives us a graphical designer. And right now, I have an event hook as a trigger. When a build in Visual Studio Team System completes, now I'm giving it my account name, I'm telling it what my project name is, and I'm giving it a polling interval. Apparently, this is not using webhooks. Apparently, this is more through polling. When a build completes, then I want to do something else. In this case, send an email to my email address, and I'm using build definition name and build number and result as parameters. So if I go into Visual Studio Online and trigger a build, Visual Studio Team Services, and trigger a build, then I'll get an email through that workflow, for instance. So that's one example. It's just reaching out to third-party web services, in this case Visual Studio Team Systems, Office 365. So let's quickly schedule it, or queue it, all right, and then we wait. And while we wait, we do something else, of course. We create another workflow, another logic app from scratch. So let's add logic app. All right. And for that logic app, we actually take our API docs here. I've deployed that onto an Azure API app. Azure API app is a web app, basically a platform as a service web server. That we can use. Let's call that test 2. All right. The new logic app. Let's close that. should be here in a moment, test two. And then we can go in and either pick one of the predefined workflows, or we can start from scratch. We can do something like Dropbox, for instance. When a file is created in Dropbox, we have to authenticate against Dropbox. All right. Next step is, so we have to pick a folder. Whoops. It's in Dropbox. Track me. Let's pick a very short interval. Okay. When a file is created, I want to now actually call my own web service. So there is multiple ways to do it, but the fastest is here, HTTP plus Swagger. And we'll give it our Swagger API endpoint here, next. And it immediately reads it, shows us some description, the Swagger description here. And we can call, for instance, the tracking ID. This is the one that we tried earlier. We can call it with some tracking ID, or we can say, no, actually use the file content of the file from Dropbox. And then we can add some condition and say, whoops, let's go up. You get the theme. Let's delete it. We can add a condition, and we can say if file name contains, so we can do if statements here as well, then do something, otherwise do other things. So it's a workflow engine like we know it from Windows Workflow Foundation times, but it's built on top of Azure Resource Manager. So actually the workflow engine is Resource Manager. The same engine that executes the ARM templates is executing this workflow. And in fact, the workflow itself, when we click on code view, we see the workflow itself is written in the language that looks a lot like an ARM template. And all the boxes inside here are JSON services, REST services, sorry, using Swagger. Having said that, what have we seen? Swagger is a powerful contract. It describes your REST services. It's gonna be called OpenAPI soon. It's based on JSON Schema, but it has more than that on top. You can auto-generate all kind of things, and you can also use it with higher-level services. For instance, in Azure, we did discuss the orchestration engine, API management, and there's many other services as well. With that, there was some use Swagger and have fun, but it's nowhere here. Use Swagger, have fun, have a good rest of the evening, and thanks for joining.